Until now, William had taken no interest in his handkerchiefs as accessories. But last week, Ginger, a member of the circle known to themselves as the Outlaws, of which William was the leader, had received a handkerchief as a birthday present from an aunt in London. William, on hearing the news, had jeered. But the sight of the handkerchief had silenced him. It was a large handkerchief, larger than William had conceived it possible for handkerchiefs to be. It was made of silk and contained all the colours of the rainbow. Round the edge, green dragons sported upon a red ground. Ginger displayed it, fully prepared for scorn and merriment. But there was something about the handkerchief that impressed them all. The next morning, Henry appeared with a handkerchief almost exactly like it, and the day after that, Douglas had one. William felt his prestige lowered. He, the born leader, was the only one of the select circle who did not possess a coloured silk handkerchief. That evening he approached his mother.
"I don't think white ones is much use," he said.
"Don't scrape your feet on the carpet, William," said his mother placidly. "I thought white ones were the only tame kind. Not that I think your father will let you have any more. You know what he said when they got all over the floor and bit his finger?"
"I'm not talking about rats," said William. "I'm talking about handkerchiefs."
"Oh, handkerchiefs. White ones are far the best. There's nothing better than white linen."
"Personally," said William, with a judicial air, "I think silk's better than linen, and white's so tiring to look at. I think a kind of colour's better for your eyes. My eyes do ache a bit sometimes. I think it's probably with keep looking at white handkerchiefs."
"Don't be silly, William. I'm not going to buy you silk handkerchiefs to get covered with mud and ink and coal, as yours do." William decided to investigate Robert's bedroom. He opened Robert's dressing-table drawer and turned over the handkerchiefs. He caught his breath with surprise and pleasure. There, beneath all Robert's other handkerchiefs, was a larger, silkier, more multicoloured handkerchief than Ginger's or Douglas's or Henry's. He gazed at it in ecstatic joy. He slipped it into his pocket and, standing before the looking-glass, took it out with a flourish, shaking its lustrous folds. He was absorbed in this occupation when Robert entered.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Oh, I just wanted to borrow a handkerchief, Robert. I thought you wouldn't mind lending me this handkerchief."
"Well, I would," said Robert curtly. "Give it back to me."
Reluctantly, William handed it back to Robert.
"How much will you give it me for?" he said.
"Well, how much have you?" said Robert ruthlessly.
Nothing just at present," admitted William. "But I'd do something for you for it. I'd do anything you want done for it. You just tell me what to do for it, and I'll do it."
"Well, you can get the bishop's handkerchief for me, and then I'll give mine to you."
The trouble with Robert was that he imagined himself a wit. The trouble with William was that he took things literally. The bishop was expected in the village the next day. It was the great event of the summer. He was a distant relation of the vicar's. He was to open the sale of work, address a large meeting on temperance, spend the night at the vicarage, and depart the next morning. The bishop was a fatherly, simple-minded old man of 70. He enjoyed the sale of work, except for one thing. Wherever he looked, he met the gaze of a freckled, untidy, frowning small boy. He couldn't understand it. The boy seemed to be everywhere. The boy seemed to follow him about. Then he addressed the meeting on temperance, his audience consisting chiefly of adults. But in the very front seat, the same earnest, frowning boy fixed him with a determined gaze. After the meeting, William wandered down the road to the vicarage. He pondered gloomily over his wasted afternoon. Fate had not thrown the bishop's handkerchief in his path. But he did not yet despair. He looked cautiously through the vicarage hedge. Nothing was to be seen. He crawled inside the garden and round to the back of the house. The bishop was tired after his address. He lay outstretched upon a deck chair beneath a tree. Over the head and face of his lordship was stretched a large, superfine linen handkerchief. William's set expression brightened. On hands and knees, he began to crawl through the grass towards the portly form. Crouching behind the chair, he braced himself for the crime. He measured the distance between the chair and the garden gate. 1, 2, 3.
Then suddenly the portly form stirred, the handkerchief was firmly withdrawn by a podgy hand, and a dignified voice yawned and said,
"Hey-ho!"
At the same moment the bishop sat up. William, from his refuge behind the chair, looked wildly round. The door of the house was opening. There was only one thing to do. William was as nimble as a monkey. Like a flash of lightning, he disappeared up the tree. It was a very leafy tree. It completely concealed William, but William had a good bird's-eye view of the world beneath him. The vicar came out, rubbing his hands.
"You rested, my lord?" he said.
"Oh, I'm afraid I've had 40 winks," said his lordship pleasantly. "Just dropped off, you know. I dreamt about that boy who was at the meeting this afternoon."
"What boy, my lord?"
asked the vicar.
"I noticed him at the sale of work and the meeting. He looked a soulful boy. I dare say you know him."
The vicar considered.
"I can't think of any boy round here like that," he said.
The bishop sighed.
"It seemed an earnest, questing face, as if the boy wanted something, needed something. I hope my little talk helped him."
"Without doubt it did, my lord," said the vicar politely. "I thought we might dine out here. The days draw out so pleasantly now."
The vicar went in to order dinner in the garden. The bishop drew the delicate handkerchief once more over his rubicund features. The breast of the bishop on the lawn began to rise and sink. William took from his pocket a bent pin attached to a piece of string. He lowered this cautiously and drew the bent pin carefully onto the white linen expanse. Leaning down from his leafy retreat, William drew the bent pin sharply across. It missed the handkerchief and caught the bishop's ear. The bishop sat up with a scream. William, pin and string withdrew into the shade of the branches. The vicar ran out from the house full of concern.
I've been badly stung in the ear by some insect," said the bishop. "Some virulent tropical insect, I should think. Very painful, very painful indeed."
"My lord," said the vicar, "I'm so sorry, so very sorry, 1,000 pardons. Can I procure some remedy for you? Vaseline, ammonia, cold cream?"
No, snapped the bishop. I put my handkerchief over my face for a protection. If I had failed to do that, I should have been even more badly stung."
The vicar sat down upon his chair. The maid came out to lay the table. They watched her in silence. William shifted his position in the tree.
"Do you know," said the bishop, "I believe there's a cat in the tree. Several times I've heard a slight rustling."
It would have been far better for William to remain silent, but William's genius occasionally misled him. He was anxious to prevent the investigation, to prove once for all his identity as a cat. He leant forward and uttered a re-echoing meow. As imitations go, it was rather good. There was a slight silence. Then,
"It is a cat," said the bishop in triumph.
"Excuse me, my lord," said the vicar.
He went softly into the house and returned holding a shoe.
"This will settle his feline majesty," he smiled.
Then he hurled the shoe violently into the tree.
"Shush! Scoot!"
he said as he did it. William was annoyed. The shoe narrowly missed his face. He secured it and waited.
I hope you haven't lost the shoe," said the bishop anxiously.
"Oh, no, the gardener's boy will get it for me."
He settled himself in his chair comfortably, with a smile. William leant down, held the shoe deliberately over the vicar's bald head, then dropped it.
"Oh, damn," said the vicar. Oh, excuse me, my lord."
Said the bishop. "Yes, most annoying. It lodged in a branch for a time, probably, and then obeyed the force of gravity."
The vicar was rubbing his head. William wanted to enjoy the sight of the vicar rubbing his head. He moved a little further along the branch. He forgot all caution. There was the sound of a rending and a crashing, and onto the table between the amazed vicar and bishop descended William's branch and William. The bishop gazed at him.
"Why, that's the boy," he said.
William sat up among the debris of broken glass and crockery. He discovered that he was bruised and that his hand was cut by one of the broken glasses. He extricated himself from the branch and the table and stood rubbing his bruises and sucking his hand. "Crumbs," was all he said. The vicar was gazing at him speechlessly.
You know, my boy, said the bishop, in mild reproach, that's a very curious thing to do, to hide up there for the purpose of eavesdropping. I know that you are an earnest, well-meaning little boy, and that you were interested in my address this afternoon, and I dare say you were hoping to listen to me again, but this is my time for relaxation, you know. Suppose the vicar and I had been talking about something we didn't want you to hear. I'm sure you wouldn't like to listen to things people didn't want you to hear, would you?
William stared at him in unconcealed amazement. The vicar, with growing memories of shoes and dams, and with murder in his heart, was picking up twigs and broken glass. He knew that he could not, in the bishop's presence, say the things to William and do the things to William that he wanted to do and say. He contented himself with saying, "You'd better go home now. Tell your father I'll be coming to see him tomorrow."
"A well-meaning little boy, I'm sure," said the bishop kindly. "Well-meaning, but unwise. Yes, unwise. But your attentiveness during the meeting did you credit, my boy? Did you credit?"
William turned to go. He knew when he was beaten. He'd spent a lot of time and trouble and had not secured the episcopal handkerchief. He had bruised himself and cut himself. He understood the vicar's veiled threat. He saw all his future pocket money vanish into nothingness with the cost of the vicar's glasses and plates. He wouldn't have minded if he'd got the handkerchief. He wouldn't have minded anything if...
"Don't suck your hand, my boy," said the bishop. "An open cut like that is most dangerous. Poison works into the system by it. You remember I told you how the poison of alcohol works into the system? Well, any kind of poison can work into it by a cut. No, no, don't suck it. Keep it covered up. Haven't you a handkerchief? Oh, here, take mine. You needn't trouble to return it. It's an old one."
The bishop was deeply touched by what he called the bright spirituality of the smile with which William thanked him. William, limping slightly, his hand covered by a grimy rag, came out into the garden, drawing from his pocket with a triumphant flourish an enormous, violently coloured silk handkerchief. Robert, who was weeding the rose bed, looked up. "Here," he called, "you can jolly well go and put that handkerchief of mine back." William continued his proud advance.
"'S all right," he called airily. "The bishop's is on your dressing table."
Robert dropped the trowel.
"What?"
he gasped, and hastened indoors to investigate. William went down to the gate, smiling very slightly.
"The days are drawing out so pleasantly,"
he was saying to himself in a mincing accent.
"Vaseline, ammonia, or cold cream, damn."
He leant over the gate and looked up and down the road. In the distance he caught sight of the figure of his friend.
"Ginger!"
he yelled. He waved his coloured handkerchief carelessly in greeting as he called. Then he swaggered out into the road.